Much has been made in some circles about Admiral Fisher's sometimes apparently unhinged statements and speeches. And to be fair, his use of all caps, triple underlining and very bombastic wording and a lot of red ink would mean he'd probably thrive on the modern day internet. But this analysis only really works if you focus on the most bellicose of Fisher's statements in isolation, and if you look at it through the lens of modern political sensitivities, as utterly hypocritical and nonsensical as the latter often are. But when you consider the broader scope of his statements and writings, as well as his actual actions when he was in office as first Sea Lord in the middle of the 1900s, you begin to realise three major issues that are very often ignored. First, Fisher was, if anything, a very militant pacifist. Now, that might sound a little bit contradictory, but he could see how much slaughter a full-scale industrial war between great powers would cause, and he wanted to avoid that by almost any means necessary. Two, he did, however, have a pretty good grasp of human nature in general, and the nature of politicians and other national leaders in particular. And that was simply, words meant nothing if they were not backed up by action, and in general, any nation with resources bent on expansionism could only be reined in by either the threat of the use of overwhelming force or the actual use of overwhelming force. And the threat would only be effective if the receiving party genuinely believed that you would go through with the latter. And thus it would be necessary, as head of the Royal Navy, the largest fleet of the most powerful empire, to wield the power he had with the usually figurative and sometimes literal appearance of a madman on a hair trigger, simply so no one would dare step out of line. But if they did, then the Royal Navy would have to back up words with actions quickly, and if necessary, with unstoppable impact. The third issue is, his methods actually worked, and often in spite of the best efforts of the British political establishment to blindly catapult everybody into war through a combination of naivety and ignorance. Now, of course, those are some pretty serious claims to make, but I think I can back them up. So let's look at a case study of Fisher in action during his time as first Sea Lord in the middle of the 1900s, when it may well be argued that he actually stopped World War I from happening almost a decade before it actually ended up breaking out. So to set the scene, it's early 1905. Fisher has taken up the office of first Sea Lord just a few months earlier in October 1904, and the political landscape of Europe is shifting quite rapidly. Historically, Britain had worried about two major European powers, the French and the Russians. However, in recent decades, Germany had formed from a collection of smaller states, and Italy had come into existence only a little earlier than that. These two nations, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which, although the successor of the Austrian Empire was itself also less than 50 years old in its current form, had formed the Triple Alliance. This power bloc, which from a British perspective could threaten both the Mediterranean and the North Sea and Atlantic, as well as beyond, with entirely separate navies, was understandably quite concerning, never mind their potential ambitions to dominate continental Europe. This, along with the French experiences in the Franco-Prussian War, had led to a gradual thawing of relations between Britain and France, with the Entente Cordiale between the two being agreed in 1904. This alliance was still new and tentative, though, and the British had another alliance, the Anglo-Japanese Alliance, which they'd entered into a couple of years prior to that, and which was aimed in part at stymieing Russian, and any other nations, but mostly Russian, ambitions in the Pacific. Those Russian ambitions had collided with Japanese ambitions, and the net result had been the Russo-Japanese War, which was still going on in early 1905 and not going especially well for the Russians. The Pacific Squadron had been attacked and mostly destroyed, and almost simultaneous to Fisher's ascension to First Sea Lord had been the sailing of the majority of the Russian Baltic Fleet, renamed to the 2nd Pacific Squadron or 2nd Pacific Fleet, depending on how charitable you wanted to be. As a result, one of the very first things that Fisher needed to deal with once in office was the Russians shooting up the British fishing fleet in the North Sea, having mistaken them for Japanese torpedo boats, and the near war with Russia that had then resulted. However, the sailing of the fleet had led to an entirely separate diplomatic crisis, which was that, in terms of the Russo-Japanese War, Britain was technically allied with both sides. The more obvious one was, of course, the direct alliance with the Japanese. Article 2 of this particular alliance meant that if one or the other party got involved in a war in the Western Pacific or over concerns regarding the Western Pacific, the other would declare neutrality. However, Article 3 stated that if either party got involved in a war with two or more powers over these issues, then the other party would join their ally directly. So far, Japan was only at war with Russia, and so Britain had declared neutrality. This was a big hit to Russia, as the rules of war meant that British-controlled ports and colliers, if they were going to be neutral, were effectively out of their reach. And since Britain controlled the largest number of ports and the most of the world's colliers, that was a huge issue for the voyage of the Russian fleet which was going around the world. Technically speaking, they could seek shelter in British imperial harbours for up to 24 hours at a time, but that was nowhere near enough time to even begin to coal an entire fleet, let alone do the basic maintenance. And of course, just because they were allowed in the port for 24 hours didn't mean there was any obligation to actually sell them any coal. Or if they did sell them coal and other supplies, there was no obligation to sell it at anything approaching a reasonable price. But Russia did have an ally of its own, namely France, with which it had teamed up in the early 1890s by way of their own alliance. The French Overseas Empire was the second largest in the world behind the British, and thus offered a potential source of shelter and coal for the Russian fleet. The problem was that, due to the laws of neutrality, if France maintained neutrality as well, she also could only offer shelter for just 24 hours at a time, which was of relatively little help, as we've just discussed, although, of course, France could afford to be a bit more generous with providing coal. Alternatively, they could allow the Russians to stay in harbour longer, which was obviously far more useful, but would also mean breaking the rules of neutrality. And thus, if the Russian fleet stayed for several days, it could then be argued that France was showing material support for a belligerent in the Russo-Japanese War, and thus was at war with Japan by proxy. That would activate Article 3 of the Anglo-Japanese Alliance and force Britain to declare war on both France and Russia to support Japan. And that would almost certainly lead to the annihilation of the Russian fleet before ever it got anywhere near the Pacific, as well as the probable destruction of the French fleet and the loss of French overseas colonies to both the British and the Japanese, since the Marine Nationale of 1905 was in no position to meaningfully challenge the Royal Navy. But of course, this posed the second and less obvious problem. Britain, as we said, was now allied with France, mostly to contain Germany. And thus it wasn't in either Britain's interests nor in the interests of France to actually fight each other, as such conflict would weaken both and divide them just when Germany might well exploit the situation for its own gains. And so the French faced their own quandary. Offer minimal help to the Russians in order to maintain a solid alliance with Britain against Germany, or help the Russians, provoking a war between Britain and France and Britain and Russia, which, as we've just covered, will probably not help the Russians all that much, and then watch Britain and Germany carve up the world between them before probably inevitably fighting each other over the remains of France and Russia's empires. And there was a third element to all of this. The Japanese actually preferred Britain to stay neutral if it meant that they could force France to stay neutral as well, since the Imperial Japanese Navy was just about confident they could deal with the Russians, as long as that long voyage around the world was made quite difficult, but the French had enough relatively experienced ships scattered across the Indian and Pacific Oceans that a second Pacific fleet reinforced by these vessels and offered extensive shelter in French-controlled ports might be too much to handle, especially since a good chunk of the Royal Navy's firepower was about to be drawn back to home waters and the Mediterranean, and thus would take some time to get over to the Pacific to help out. And so, with a war in the Pacific seeing Europe engaged in something akin to a Mexican standoff between heavily armed octopi, the Kaiser saw an opportunity to destabilize the entire continent to Germany's advantage, because of course he did. His only problem was Fischer was way ahead of him and was anticipating the Kaiser trying exactly that. Thus, shortly after taking office, Fischer is supposed, we only have second-hand reports to this, to have told the king of his idea to deal with Germany beginning to throw its weight around. He said to the king, "We'll have a picnic in Kiel. We'll just go along and put two British ships, on one on each side of a German, and then say to the Germans, as a policeman says to a drunk, come along quietly and there'll be no trouble. But if you don't, then there will be trouble, and no mistake about it." This was classic British naval power politics on a grand scale. If anything, it was somewhat tame and restrained compared to other statements Fischer had made about just going straight to reenacting Copenhagen and blowing the German fleet out of the water with no warning whatsoever. However, the idea of such an open and aggressive display of power as a deterrent predictably horrified the politicians, who saw only the risk of precipitating the Continental War that everyone was at least agreed they wanted to avoid, whereas Fischer thought that doing nothing, or attempting to appease the Germans, would be a far more likely route to conflict. His civilian counterpart, the First Lord of the Admiralty, upon hearing of Fischer's plans, wrote to the Prime Minister shortly after, and said, "To tell you the truth, this is another proof of that Fischer's intellectual flaws are on the same great scale as his intellectual virtues. Told you his proposal about the German fleet at Kiel? It was no line of paradox, nor said to shock. He meant it." However, it seems that this proposal was actually just Fischer's opening salvo, not a full plan of attack. If he meant for the Royal Navy to waltz into Kiel and simply steal the high seas fleet, then it would have been an operation conducted in the greatest secrecy. Instead, Fischer blithely and gladly confirmed the substance of this proposal to pretty much anyone who would listen or ask, including a number of journalists, ensuring that the idea rapidly spread throughout the British public and, of course, over to Europe, specifically Berlin, which, of course, was entirely the point, as the first stage of Fischer's actual plan was to see if the Germans could be deterred by a simple indirect verbal reminder of just who exactly they were messing with. It's almost certainly not a coincidence that around the same time the British press, who Fischer saw as just another weapon to be wielded and who had fairly close connections to him, suddenly began publishing articles that laid into the German fleet's mere existence with considerable vitriol. One paper noted that with the Baltic fleet mostly away, that's the Russian Baltic fleet, at that point they were somewhere off the coast of Africa, there was no better time for the British to sail into the Baltic, wipe out the German fleet without the risk of being backstabbed by the Russians, then head over to finish off what was left of the Russian fleet in any case, and thus at a stroke eliminate two-thirds of all the navies that could potentially be a threat to British dominance, since bereft of support and harried by British warships all the way to the Pacific and the waiting Japanese, the 2nd Pacific Squadron would surely be doomed as well. Predictably, the Germans protested this sudden upswing of rhetoric, which led to the immensely British snark of the Army and Navy Gazette's reply to said protest, which read in part, "It was not the Army and Navy Gazette that demanded that the German fleet should be wiped out of existence. We merely pointed out that the British fleet at the present time has no particular business of importance at hand." Of course, implying that the Royal Navy might just go up and blow up or steal the entirety of Germany's battle fleet, in part out of sheer boredom, only caused further German ire. Which, of course, was the point, since the more angry the Germans were about the threat, the more, it was hoped, they might realise that Britain could in fact do this, and thus it would be a good idea perhaps not to antagonise the people who could do this. Indeed, by the turn of the year, the Germans had half convinced themselves that the lack of any official censure to the press stories, combined with Fischer's ongoing gathering of the Royal Navy's strength in home waters, meant that such an attack was indeed being at least strongly considered, if not actively being planned at that very moment. When questioned, of course, British diplomats denied any such attack was planned. But that just fed into the Kaiser's thinking that, well, this is just further confirmation that such an attack is being planned, because of course, if the British were planning attack, they would deny that they were planning said attack. And thus, by early 1905, the Kaiser had issued orders to prepare his fleet for a possible surprise attack that spring, asking both the Army and Navy how best they might combat it. The best that they could come up with was a preemptive attack of their own. When they felt that the British might be at sea, the German army would have to rapidly mobilise and invade Denmark, of all places, as that would give them control of the Danish belts, the passages between the various islands that make up the eastern portion of Denmark and which divide Denmark and Sweden. In these narrow and somewhat treacherous waters, which usually required local pilots to guide ships through, it was hoped that a combination of mines, torpedoes, the Danish coastal defences, the lack of local guides, and the confined nature of the passages preventing the British from fully utilising their numbers would allow for a successful repulse of any British fleet. Of course, if they got it wrong and the British weren't coming, or even if they invaded Denmark just a little bit early, say while the British were still in the middle of the North Sea, then either the British wouldn't be coming at all, or they could break off in the middle of an approach, which would leave the Germans holding the bag of having randomly invaded a neutral neighbour for seemingly no reason other than sheer paranoia, which would leave Germany an international pariah, thus playing directly into British hands, especially since Britain might then call for an international conference, and at said conference, insist on the removal of the majority of the German fleet by general treaty to other powers, probably them, on the grounds that, well, the Kaiser clearly couldn't be trusted with the big boys' toys. But you'll recall that I mentioned that the Germans had already seen a chance to take advantage of the general political situation, and Fischer, by his press leaks and so forth, was responding to it. So what exactly had the Germans done? Well, already in late 1904, the Kaiser had approached the Russians with the idea of getting their support in jointly closing off the Baltic to anyone they didn't approve of, like the British. The Kaiser tried to use Germany's position of relative strength with the recent sailing of the bulk of the Baltic fleet as both leverage and to play into fears of the British exploiting Russian weakness, even if the Russians thought it was a temporary weakness at the time. This particular attempt had ended up falling apart because the Russians had insisted on getting their ally France involved in the talks, whereas the Kaiser insisted on only telling the French once the deal was done, on the grounds that the French would most likely tell the British under the terms of the Entente Cordiale, and the British would then attack immediately before defensive preparations could be complete, which showed that the Kaiser was already worried about a Royal Navy surprise attack in the Baltic before Fischer fanned the flames of that particular fear. But soon, the Kaiser would try and play another card in response to Fischer's attempts to deter him. But just as the immediate panic of January 1905 was beginning to cool off in Germany, a friend of Fischer's in the civil administration of the Admiralty made a speech in which he said in part, "If it comes to war, the British Navy would get its blow in first, before the other side had time even to read the papers that war had been declared." Which might as well have been prefaced by "Admiral Fischer says," given both the language and the timing. But it was, of course, also perfectly deniable on Fischer's part, since he wasn't the one who'd actually said it. And while the Kaiser began looking into the possibility of entering a defensive alliance with Denmark, as he thought that this would be even faster and perhaps a little bit more internationally palatable than mobilising his army and invading it, he also now looked to drive a wedge between Britain and France. This was his new card, as we'd just alluded to, driven in part by the French trying to play both sides in the Russo-Japanese War. You see, by April, the 2nd Pacific Squadron had almost reached Japanese waters, but was in something of a desperate state. Luckily for them, they'd found shelter in Camran Bay and were in the process of refitting and refueling there. This, of course, took some time, several weeks in fact, helped by colliers from the Hamburg America line, which was, of course, German. But the big problem was that Camran Bay was part of what is now Vietnam, but at the time was known as French Indochina. The French were helping their allies, but massively breaching the rules of neutrality in doing so. The Japanese asked the British to put pressure on the French to kick out the Russians, and while the British tried to do that, they were trying to work out how to do so without starting a war in Europe. And that was when the Kaiser struck. He sailed to Tangier in Morocco, which as a whole was coming under steadily greater French influence. The Entente Cordiale in part had acknowledged that the area fell into the French sphere of influence and the British wouldn't get involved, and that was helped by the fact that the French already controlled Algeria, which was immediately to the east, so they had a land border with Morocco. And in Tangier, the Kaiser announced in a speech that he supported Moroccan independence from French control, and he also expressed his desire for a German base on the Atlantic coast, quite possibly a Moroccan port, much as how various European powers, including Germany, had bought, leased, or outright claimed, or seized, various ports in the Far East, mostly from China. This, of course, was a direct challenge to France, and was recognised as such. But it was also an excellent power play. With Morocco on the African coast, any enforcement of control or independence, whichever way it went, would rely heavily on sea power. And that meant the need for at least the tacit approval, or possibly even outright assistance from, the Royal Navy. But with Britain currently at odds with France over the Russo-Japanese War, they couldn't easily turn around and help the French with this new situation. But if they didn't, with the Russians away, the Marine Nationale alone wasn't in any real position to directly challenge the high seas fleet if they tried to enforce the Kaiser's desires. And this would therefore show the Entente Cordiale as weak. The Kaiser hoped that, faced with a choice of backing France or Japan, the British would be paralysed by indecision and not intervene, thus disillusioning the French and driving them closer to Russia, and thus himself, in an alliance against Britain. Fischer, however, recognised the power play and chose to respond. He did so in several layers. Publicly, he wrote to the government, "Without any question whatsoever, the Germans would like a port on the coast of Morocco, and without doubt whatever such a port possessed by them would be vitally detrimental to us from a naval point of view, and ought to be made a casus belli, a cause for war, unless we get Tangier, which would perhaps, but only perhaps, be a quid pro quo. This seems a golden opportunity for fighting the Germans in alliance with the French, so I earnestly hope you'll be able to bring this about. Of course, I don't pretend to be a diplomat, understatement of the century there, but it strikes me that the German Emperor will greatly injure the splendid and increasing Anglo-French Entente if he is allowed to score now in any way, even if only getting rid of Monsieur de Classe, the French foreign minister who had opposed the Kaiser's speech in Morocco and who the Germans had sought to have sacked as a result. All I hope is that you will send a telegram to Paris that the English and French fleets are one. We could have the German fleet, the Kiel Canal, and Schleswig-Holstein within a fortnight." Privately, though, while he allowed a good chunk of this to be leaked to the press, he admitted that that was mostly nonsense. The Moroccan ports, in his view, were not suitable for large ships or a large fleet, certainly not to any extent to actually worry him all that much, and Germany's cruiser fleet, which maybe could make use of a Moroccan port, was anemic at best. Plus, he was already making plans for his dreadnought armoured cruisers to deal with enemy overseas cruiser bases in any case. What he was in fact trying to do was actually far more domestic, to forcibly turn the gaze of British politics to focus on the German threat that he perceived, which he also helped would persuade the French to reduce support for the Russians, as the British would seem to be the far more useful allies against Germany if they actually focused their attention on Germany. At the end of May, the issue of French support for the Russians mostly became a non-issue, as Admiral Turgot's British-trained and mostly British-built fleet annihilated the Russian 2nd Pacific Squadron at Tsushima, diffusing some of the tension resulting from that war, since the Japanese could be very happy that their allies had ensured that they only needed to fight the Russians, and of course they'd then gone and won that fight, at least at sea. The land war would go on for a little while. And so what the French fleet and its various bases now did, short of the French outright declaring war themselves, was largely irrelevant to the further outcome of the Russo-Japanese War. The British were thus freed up to continue supporting the French in the Moroccan crisis, which resulted in the French agreeing to address the whole thing with an international conference, but with British backing. Although it should be noted that while the French appreciated Britain promising to argue in their behalf, the lack of any major deployment by the Royal Navy in May, when the Russo-Japanese naval war still hung in the balance, did perturb some French politicians. Then, about a week later, Norway declared independence from Sweden, and the Kaiser switched tactics again, looping back on his plan to try and get Russia on side. Russia was now recently humiliated, with the war in the Pacific going well against them, and they now knew the Baltic fleet would be critically under strength for some time to come. Thus, the Russians were in a much weaker position to resist the Kaiser's proposal for a Russo-German alliance this time around, especially as he pointed out that the French seemed to be cozying up to the British, which meant there would be no further help from the French against the Japanese. He also pointed out that, well, newly independent Norway would be at significant risk of falling into the British sphere of influence, in part due to the trade links that they had, and that could give the Royal Navy a foothold at the mouth of the access to the Baltic. Having thus secured tacit Russian agreement at a meeting between himself and the Tsar aboard their respective royal yachts, the Kaiser then took himself and the High Seas Fleet off to Copenhagen to acclimatise the Danes to the idea that the Baltic was now in the hands of the Germans and the Russians, and further, that in the event of any tension, well, they'd better just prepare themselves to be occupied to safeguard that control. With the British government in the process of weakening due to internal party issues and domestic politics, Fisher decided that there was both a threat and an opportunity. The threat, of course, was the government doing nothing and acceding to the Kaiser's demands, even if it was just by not actually doing anything in response. The opportunity was that, well, with the government so weak and divided, they might not notice him, that's Fisher, doing something about it until it was far too late for them to actually stop him. He thus paid a visit to the King, who was getting a bit fed up with the government as well, in order to get his approval, and he began to put into play his counter to the Kaiser's counter. Back in March, a planned cruise of the Channel Fleet to the Baltic, including a visit to Kiel, had been called off by the government in an attempt to ease tensions with Germany, as they thought it might make the Germans think that it was a cover for an actual assault. Now, it was July, and Fisher worked quickly with the King to resurrect the idea, bringing the Channel Fleet up to readiness without actually telling the cabinet what he was doing. Indeed, the first that anyone outside Fisher's group knew about the plans in any great detail was when the Admiralty leaked the cruise schedule to the press, and thus to the Germans, before the cabinet themselves were aware that the voyage was about to commence, let alone giving any time for the foreign minister to conduct the usual diplomatic disclosures. Urgently, the cabinet convened, with some pointing out that the Germans feared that this was precisely the kind of secret strike that they'd worried about, only now aimed to catch the High Seas Fleet in an even more vulnerable position as they were anchored in the otherwise neutral port of Copenhagen, rather than in their own fortified base at Kiel. However, with the King's approval of the voyage, and the date of departure so imminent, the cabinet eventually came to the conclusion that the loss of face from a last-minute cancellation, opposed by both the King and the Navy, would be far worse for their personal political prospects and national prestige as a whole than any risk of further angering the Germans. And so the Channel Fleet, under Sir Arthur Wilson, weighed anchor and proceeded into the Baltic. Traditionally, as mentioned earlier, fleets would break up into loose formation and then take on local pilots in order to navigate the belts, especially the rather narrow one between Denmark and Sweden, where Copenhagen lay. Instead, almost without warning, the entire Channel Fleet materialised, steaming at a brisk cruising speed through the most dangerous part of the belt in tight battle formation, without much of anything in the way of prior notification, and without any call for local pilots. The fleet then stood into Copenhagen, a noticeably larger force than the High Seas Fleet days earlier, and then headed off with all due ceremony to continue their tour. A couple of days after the British left Copenhagen, the High Seas Fleet was happily anchored at the German port of Swinemünde, having arrayed itself there for the viewing pleasure of the German public, who turned out in large numbers to view their fleet. And the Kaiser was there as well, as he wanted to view his fleet in conjunction with the adoring public. There was a thick fog that particular morning, which made the German ships only rough outlines when viewed from the shore, but still crowds were gathering to await the sun burning off the fog. And that was when there was the low sound of a battleship's horn, off from one side. This briefly caused some confusion, since all the German battleships were stationary and their locations known, and the horn hadn't come from any of them. And then, out of the fog, emerged the bow of a British battleship, flags and ensigns flying, followed by another, and another, and still another, and so on, as the formation swept in between the High Seas Fleet and the shore, dropping anchor in perfect parade formation, following all necessary formalities, and of course completely obscuring the Germans' view of their own fleet. But of course, the message that this sent was clear. The Royal Navy could, and would, enter the Baltic without notice, when it wanted, where it wanted, in significant force, and could literally materialise out of the fog at point-blank range in your very own ports. The effect was rapid and rather immediate. The Russians suddenly discovered they didn't actually approve of the Kaiser's alliance proposals after all, And at the same time, the French Northern Squadron and the British Atlantic Fleet were arranging reciprocal visits in Brest and Portsmouth. And as the Channel Fleet completed its Baltic tour and headed home, the French press claimed that if France were attacked, the British had agreed to seize the Kiel Canal and land 100,000 men there. The Germans naturally protested this, and the British and French governments refused to confirm or deny any such plans. As it turns out, the Admiralty had actually drawn up such plans, although whether they'd promised to tie the execution of those plans into Anglo-French relations remains unknown. What is known, however, is that Fisher was heavily involved in said planning, and of course, as we've seen, he tended to use strategic leaks to advance his plans in a deniable way. In any case, the entire German-European war plan, the Schlieffen Plan, had an entire new appendix added to it over the following years that detailed what the response would be to just such an assault. It turned out it would force several hundred thousand troops to be drawn away from any potential assault on France, even if said assault was ongoing, even if this meant stalling out said advance, while those troops headed off to deal with a British army that presumably would be sitting waiting for them on the German-Danish border. As a result of all of this, Germany stopped pushing at the European alliance framework for the moment. The Algeciras conference the following year effectively handed control of Morocco to the French, with all German conditions and objections swept aside, and when faced with the prospect of the Channel Fleet returning to the Baltic in 1906 for another cruise, the Kaiser was reduced to merely saying, "Please have a message sent to the officers not to go about on shore photographing with Kodaks like some did last year. It's bad enough to come to a place without being invited, without going about reconnoitering. We have a proverb, you know. Even a worm will turn if you tread on him." That particular cruise did actually end up being cancelled due to political instability in Russia, meaning that they didn't think that the safety of Royal Navy shore parties on shore leave could be guaranteed. But the groundwork for the Triple Entente had been laid, and while the Anglo-German naval arms race began to accelerate, German planning documents for the rest of the decade, and particularly the Kaiser's writings, were dominated by attempts to work out how to ensure that the British didn't enter a European war at all, for fear of the Royal Navy coming down like the hammer of an angry god. Fisher's policies had worked to maintain the peace, and it's notable that it was only as the 1910s progressed, with a liberal government much weakened from a 1910 election, that then sought more and more appeasement politics and downplayed the Royal Navy's potential uses, that the Kaiser began to feel more and more confident that Britain could be kept out of a future war, which in part would lead to the spiral of decisions in 1914 that finally sent the world plunging into 4 years of exactly the kind of industrialised slaughter that Fisher had sought and for a few years succeeded in preventing.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.